From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the downing of a passenger plane may have been deliberate. A warning that Yemen could fall under Iranian control. Asylum claims are pushed to a 22-year high. And HRW assesses the UN Human Rights Council.
It did adopt over 2014, 29 different resolutions on 20 different country situations.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The German Wings co-pilot appears to have deliberately crashed his aircraft into the southern French Alps, but the action does not appear to be a terrorist attack. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris that appears to be the preliminary conclusion into the cause of Tuesday's crash, based on the recorded cockpit conversation from one of the aircraft's black boxes.
Marseille prosecutor Brice Robin says German co-pilot Andreas Lubitz was alone in the cockpit when he deliberately took the Germanwings craft off autopilot and activated the descent that led to it crashing into a mountainside on Tuesday.
Alors, il a donc actionné ce bouton.
At a press conference in Marseille, Robin said that at this point of time, the most plausible explanation was that the co-pilot wanted to deliberately destroy the plane. The prosecutor stressed this was a preliminary conclusion based on the last half hour of conversation between the pilot and co-pilot retrieved from the cockpit voice recorder. He described the minutes before and during the aircraft's 8-minute descent, which ended with sounds of screaming in the cabin.
Durant les 20 premières minutes, les deux pilotes échangent tout à fait de façon normale.
Robin said the first 20 recorded minutes suggested a normal exchange between the pilot and co-pilot. Then, as the pilot prepares for the plane's landing in Dusseldorf, the co-pilot became laconic, responding in brief sentences. After that, Robin says there is the sound of a chair being pushed back and the pilot asking the co-pilot to take over the controls, presumably because he needed to go to the toilet.
C'est alors qu'il est seul aux commandes de cet avion, Airbus A320.
Robin says it was at this moment, when he was alone in the cockpit, that the 28-year-old co-pilot manipulated the buttons of the flight monitoring system to trigger the aircraft's descent. This action, the prosecutor said, can only be done deliberately.
On entend plusieurs appels du commandant de bord demandant l'accès à la cabine de pilotage.
Robin said the recording indicates that the pilot tried to get back in, but the door was locked and Lubitz did not respond. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
A correspondent for the German magazine Der Spiegel tweeted that Lubitz may have suffered from depression. Todd Curtis is the creator of the website airsafe.com and a former airline safety engineer for Boeing. VOA's Sarah William asked him if there are recent precedents for such a plane crash.
Well, there are at least three other cases I can think of where an airline pilot was either suspected or proven to have deliberately flown an aircraft and destroyed an aircraft. One was in 1997 involving a Silk Air 737, and Silk Air was a subsidiary of Singapore Airlines. And there it was a suspicious circumstance where the plane crashed in a river, all on board were killed, and there was nothing heard on the cockpit voice recorder from the co-pilot for quite some time. The suspicion was, given some other background information, that the pilot did it. Then we can fast forward a couple of years to 1999, which is very familiar to many listeners in America and Egypt, the Egypt Air flight that crashed off the east coast of the United States, where the NTSB concluded that the co-pilot deliberately flew the aircraft into the ocean. The implication was that it was a murder-suicide situation. But again, the only thing that personally I would agree to is that there was a deliberate action on the part of the co-pilot. And some years ago, there was an Air Botswana pilot who took off alone in a turboprop airliner and crashed it into two others on the ground, killing himself and destroying three airliners.
Now, as I said, an investigation is underway. Would it be possible, though, I mean, generally when someone applies to work at an airline and to have such an important, responsible job as being a pilot, I would think a security check would be undertaken.
Well, I can't speak to the rules in Europe and specifically in Germany about hiring employees, but in the United States and elsewhere, there are a lot of restrictions as to what one can ask of a person who's a potential employee. And certainly some aspects of their past medical history may be off limits for even an employer to talk about. But of course, if someone has done something that's in the public domain, for example, an arrest record, having done a particular kind of act, well, that's certainly something that would be open to the employer to look at. Now, more specifically, when it comes to certifying a pilot to fly, whether it's an airline pilot or another kind of pilot, it's common to have a medical test routinely done to ensure that the pilot is medically fit to fly. But in most countries, that test doesn't include a check for all sorts of psychiatric or psychological issues. And, of course, if someone has never demonstrated, I don't know about the German Wings pilot, but someone has no history of any sort of psychotic break or psychological misbehavior, that sort of thing, there may be no reason for an airline to suspect that someone may be unfit to fly for those reasons.
Now, apparently, the indications are that the pilot left the cockpit and then was not able to apparently, you know, open the door, and so this co-pilot was flying the plane. Are pilots allowed to leave when a plane is flying?
Well, certainly for very practical reasons. In virtually, for virtually every airline, pilots are allowed to leave because, except for some very specific exceptions, cockpits don't have bathrooms. So especially on a flight that's taking any period of time, obviously there will be those physical needs that would have to be dealt with. And most cockpits don't have any sort of galley or food preparation facility. So if a pilot needs water, food, et cetera, they would have to get it from outside. Now, what is differing between the U.S. and other countries is the procedures that are taking place when the pilot is out of the cockpit. There may be a requirement to have a second party in the cockpit at all times. There may be other requirements depending on the airline, but again, those are typically airline requirements. Specific regulatory requirements would be up to the civil aviation authority of each individual country.
Because I think if I remember correctly, after 9/11, there was great importance was given to the sort of separation between the cockpit and the rest of the flight.
Well, certainly. The standard before 9/11 was that the cockpit doors were literally designed to be easily penetrated for any number of reasons, for preventing smoke, for accessing an emergency, that sort of thing. But, of course, post-9/11, that philosophy changed. And the armored door concept was there to protect outsiders from coming in. And apparently, in this case, that's exactly what happened. Once that person was outside of the aircraft, it was impossible for the person to come back in.
Todd Curtis of airsafe.com. Saudi warplanes led a new offensive against Houthi rebels in Yemen today as Gulf Arab allies and others in the region rushed to aid internationally backed President Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi. Yemen's foreign minister warns that the country could come under Iran's domination if Shia Houthi rebels establish their control. Speaking from Egypt, Foreign Minister Riyad Yassin urged the international community to support President Abdel Rabu Mansour Hadi.
The enemies of Yemen are not only the Houthis, Abdullah Saleh, and Iran, but also time. It is not in our favor. I am saying that a fast intervention could still save Yemen from a civil war or a takeover by Iran, which would make it an Iranian land next to Saudi Arabia in control of the Bab al-Mandab Strait. It is less costly to intervene now. Once they take over Yemen, it will be difficult to remove them.
Shia Houthi rebels are from the far north of Yemen and enjoyed little support in the rest of the country. Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists in Yemen consider them heretics and could use the unrest to expand their own influence in the region. The conflict has brought response from Washington. Here is Pentagon spokesperson Steve Warren.
These are terrorists who want very much to strike outside of Yemen. So this has been our focus. And although we have withdrawn our remaining personnel in Yemen. Make no mistake, the United States of America retains the ability to conduct counterterror operations anywhere in the world.
With the departure of President Hadi, the West would lose an important ally in fighting terrorism in the region. An international effort is underway to find a negotiated settlement before the situation spins out of control. Here is U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki.
The Houthis' actions have consistently undermined Yemen's transition. Recent actions are but the latest in a series of violent actions perpetrated by the Houthis since they overran Sana'a, took over government institutions, and attempted to govern by unilateral decree.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki. Ambassador Hani Khalaf, former Egyptian ambassador to the Arab League, tells VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi that the current military campaign against the Houthis could help fix the power imbalance in Yemen, which derailed the political dialogue.
Well, I think the military action made so far by the Saudis, along with some other Gulf states, are not meant to be intervening completely in the overall political process. It's only meant to balance the already existing power among the local factions. I think once the legitimate government is enforced by such military action, then the outcome of the political talks, which are being conducted by the UN representative Jamal Ben Omar, would be leading to, hopefully, more fruitful results. But during the last few weeks, the military balance between the local factions have been already in favor of the Houthis, while the other legitimate troops have been already defeated along the northern part of Yemen, and even with threatening the capital of the southern of Yemen. Now, I think the balance of power in the field may come to a point where both powers are even, and that would help promoting or pushing forward the peace talks or for this political solution.
Ambassador Hani Khalaf, former Egyptian ambassador to the Arab League. U.S. Central Command says U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in support of Iraqi security forces fighting the Islamic State group in Tikrit commenced Wednesday for the first time following a request by Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi. Defense officials say the coalition is also providing airborne intelligence and advise and assist support at Iraq's security force headquarters. Colin Clark is an associate political scientist with the RAND Corporation. He was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty whether this is a change in U.S. strategy in conducting air operations over Iraq.
I don't know if it's a significant change in the U.S. strategy in Iraq. It's certainly a change in the more recent offensive in Tikrit, which has been ongoing for the past 3 weeks and has seemed to have stalled out more recently.
Why has it stalled out?
I think ISIS fighters are dug in. They know the territory. And this isn't an easy area to overtake. As you know, this is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and so there's probably still some deep ties and some loyalty of hardline Sunnis in the area.
Why did the Baghdad government, which has not previously asked for such support, did so this time?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's tough to say, other than the fact that they possibly could have foreseen this offensive as being more successful than it has been, and then realized that it's really the U.S. that can provide the airstrikes, the airborne intelligence capabilities, and the advise and assist support to the Iraqi security forces that are most needed to be successful.
Colin, was the Iraqi decision not to ask for U.S. air support a tactical mistake?
I don't think so. I mean, again, we're only 3 weeks into this battle. So, you know, from an American perspective, there's likely an attempt to give the Iraqis some decision-making autonomy, which is exactly what they've displayed. So by eschewing air support or a request initially, I think that was a positive sign, as the Iraqis are, making their own decisions. Now, subsequently, they've decided that they needed the air support, and so they asked for it and received it. And so I think that's overall a positive sign.
The Pentagon says they're going to be targeting key IS facilities. What might they be targeting that is needed?
The typical things that you'd think of, so command and control nodes, communication networks, vehicles, weapons depots, and the like.
This brings U.S. forces in somewhat closer proximity with Iranian-backed forces and Shia militia. Is that a problem?
I don't know if it's a problem. It's certainly interesting, and it's unique from those that are watching this, and perhaps that was one of the reasons why the Iraqis hesitated in calling for U.S. support, was because of this fairly unique and interesting dynamic of the Iranians working so closely there.
What exactly is the Iranian role in the offensive?
The Iranians are training the Shia militia and advising the Shia militia that are fighting alongside the Iraqi security forces for the most part, probably providing some sort of intelligence as well as some training.
Who's taking the lead in this? Is it the Iraqi security forces?
I think it's overall the Iraqi security forces with some assistance by other actors.
They've had a checkered past in recent months, having ceded so much territory to Islamic State. How are they performing so far?
Yeah, I think on balance, it's still a bit too early to tell. This is going to be a long, hard-fought conflict, and just analyzing these kind of micro battles doesn't tell the whole story. So if the Iraqi security forces were extremely successful in the next couple of weeks, we wouldn't say writ large that the Iraqi security forces have turned a corner. I think it's still a bit too early to say whether or not this fight against ISIS has been a success or not.
Colin Clark with the RAND Corporation. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports wars in Syria and Iraq have pushed the number of asylum claims in industrialized countries to a 22-year high. Lisa Schlein has details from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UNHCR report Asylum Trends 2014 estimates 866,000 new asylum applications were lodged in 44 of the world's richest countries last year. This is a 45% increase over 2013. The agency says the 2014 figure is the highest since 1992, when the war in Bosnia-Herzegovina forced hundreds of thousands of people to flee their homes. The report finds almost 150,000 applications, or one in every five asylum claims in the industrialized world, were lodged by Syrians, making them the largest group of asylum seekers last year. It says Iraqis were the second largest group, followed by Afghans, Serbians, and Eritreans. Data show Germany was the largest receiving country with 173,000 applications, one quarter of them Syrians. Ranking second was the United States with more than 120,000 asylum claims, mostly from Mexico and countries in Central America. Turkey, Sweden, and Italy complete the list of the top five countries receiving asylum requests. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says Italy registered 63,700 new applications in 2014, the highest on record. She says the asylum seekers came mainly from Mali, Nigeria, and Gambia.
Most of the boat arrivals across the Mediterranean are landing in Italy, but most of the people who land don't stay in Italy, but make their way to other countries in Europe. So it seems that those who do stay behind are mainly from the three African countries I just named. The largest groups of people arriving, these are Syrians and Eritreans, made up over 50% of the boat arrivals. They are actually moving, for the vast majority of them, are moving on.
The Russian Federation is not included in this report, but the UNHCR says it is interesting to note that Russia received some 265,400 applications for temporary asylum and 5,800 applications for refugee status from Ukrainians during 2014. Fleming told VOA other countries should replicate the generosity being shown by Germany and Sweden, especially in regard to Syrian asylum seekers who are placing an enormous burden on neighboring countries.
We have 3.9 million Syrian refugees, many of whom used to believe that and were convinced that this war was going to end, that their situation was temporary, that their tent was temporary, that their child being out of school for 1 or 2 years was temporary, and that they were going to go back home and rebuild their lives. What we're seeing now is a trend towards hopelessness. This is why we're seeing, we believe, growing numbers of Syrians crossing the Mediterranean to reach Europe.
While most industrialized countries saw increases in the number of asylum claims last year, some countries registered a decrease, most notably Australia. The report says numbers there went down 24% from 11,700 in 2013 to less than 9,000 in 2014. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Human Rights Watch has analyzed voting by the UN Human Rights Council members in 2014 and has a mixed assessment of the balloting. Peggy Hicks, Global Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch in New York.
There are some good developments. There was action on Sri Lanka that we'd hoped for a long time, on North Korea. But on other situations, the council, you know, isn't stepping up and doing what needs to be done, places like Libya and Iraq, where it adopted weak resolutions, and places that haven't even been talked about in resolutions as they should be, like Egypt or Uzbekistan.
Well, let's start with Sri Lanka. What did they do right there?
Well, this is a work in progress for many years. Basically, we've been looking for a real investigation that would provide some accountability for the horrendous abuses that could have killed tens of thousands in the final days of the conflict in 2009. And that resolution went through, and since then, of course, we've seen a change in government and some steps going forward in Sri Lanka. So I do think it's an example of how the council has finally, you know, done what it needed to do.
And in North Korea?
In North Korea, the council has played a great role. It moved over a series of years to adopt a resolution by consensus, meaning that Russia and China and every country was on board for it. And then following that, rather than sort of just sitting on that, they put in place a commission of inquiry, which really shone a spotlight on North Korea that just hadn't happened in a long time. And in fact, the work in Geneva has now moved over to New York, where in New York we're working to get an agenda, North Korea, on the agenda at the Security Council here. So it's been a real game changer to push for human rights change in North Korea.
But you were disappointed with what happened, or I should say what did not happen, for the Middle East, North Africa.
Yes, absolutely. On Libya, for example, which is a horrendous human rights situation, which deteriorated rapidly over the course of 2014, one of the problems is that the council has addressed it only under an item on its agenda which allows for looking at technical assistance and situations that, you know, you need some work done on, but that aren't real crises. And it didn't step in when the situation got worse over 2014 to do more. On Iraq, it engaged, but unfortunately it looked only at ISIS abuses and not at the overall situation there, where we have reported, as has the UN now, on abuses by Shia militias and Iraq's security forces as well. And unfortunately, that's a problem that's continuing as we speak, where another resolution on Iraq is being proposed, a resolution that Iraq itself drafted and was being proposed by the Arab group, which again takes this sort of partial approach to looking at the situation in Iraq.
There's been a lot of controversy about what's going on in Egypt and their move towards democracy.
Yes, absolutely. Egypt's a place where it's really inexplicable that the council isn't addressing the huge deterioration in human rights there. Obviously, Human Rights Watch was a strong critic of the Mubarak regime and the human rights abuses at that time, but we hear from our people on the ground and elsewhere that it is really worse today in terms of the role that civil society is not able to play in the country. There's been a huge crackdown, and of course, there is the massacre that happened in Rabah Square with hundreds dead, which for which there's been no accountability, as well as, you know, massive death sentences ordered by the Egyptian courts. It's a really horrendous situation and needs more attention, but unfortunately just has not made its way onto the Human Rights Council's agenda.
Well, are you optimistic for next year?
We are. I mean, what we've seen over the course of the time that the Human Rights Council has been in existence is a real trend upwards towards engagement more constructively in more human rights situations. So while I've talked about some of the problems, the reality is that it did adopt over 2014 29 different resolutions on 20 different country situations. So that old misperception that, you know, the council is only looking at the situation in Palestine or Israel is simply not the case anymore, and they are doing effective work on places like Syria and the other places I've talked about. So I do think there's room to move the council forward further, and we'd love to see them take action on places like Egypt, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, where there's been a crackdown on human rights as well. So there's plenty of work to be done, but it is playing an important role as well.
Peggy Hicks, Global Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch in New York. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.